Honourable members, I take that the presentation is visible, Honourable Chair.
Yes, it is. I think you can just present it in presentation form, because whilst members may have it, there are others who are on the platform who don't have it, so that they may be able to follow correctly. So we are in your hands, sir. Please proceed.
Thank you very much. I have put it in a presentation format. Good morning, honourable members. Good morning, members and the officials, as well as the public at large. Our presentation this morning on the is on the quarter four deviations and expansions. There's two presentations I will make. The next presentation would be on the rationale and objectives of the new instruction notes that seeks to address a number of issues within the public procurement sphere. If I may kickstart with the deviations for quarter four, the presentation outline is as reflected on the screen. If I may cover the legislative basis as we normally do, the legislative mandate for us with regards to the presentation stems out from Treasury Regulation 16A 6.4, which indicates that if in a specific case it is impractical to invite competitive bids, the accounting officer or accounting authority may procure the required goods or services by other means, provided that the reasons for deviating from inviting competitive bids must be recorded and approved by the accounting officer or accounting authority. What I would like us to take note of, Honourable Chair, is what the instruction says. It speaks of the accounting officer or the accounting authority. You would take note when we discuss the rationale for revision or for publication of the new instruction note. It will revolve around these regulations, specifically the PFMA. What we have then is SCM instruction number 2 of 2122, which indicated the thresholds. And it also indicates that within 10 working days of having the of the contract award or approval, that the relevant Treasury and Auditor General must be informed of all the deviations above that threshold. The instruction note 3 of 2016-17 specific reference to section of paragraph 8 of the instruction note indicates that the accounting officer or the accounting authority must only deviate from inviting competitive bids in cases where there is emergencies or there is a sole supplier status. It also indicates that defines what an emergency procurement would be, which indicates that it must be immediate risk to health, life or property or the surrounding environment. And there is insufficient time for competitive bids to be requested or solicited. Paragraph 8.3 says that a sole source procurement may only occur where there's only one bidder or one sufficient or one supplier that could satisfy the needs that are identified. If I may jump to 8.5, it says any other deviation will be allowed in exceptional cases, subject to the prior written approval from the relevant Treasury. Paragraph 9 speaks of the expansion or variation of orders. If I may jump to 9.2 of the paragraph, it says any deviation in excess of the prescribed threshold will only be allowed in exceptional cases, subject to prior written approval from the relevant Treasury. This background sketch the scene for the next coming sections of the presentation, indicating what were the conditions or the circumstances that were allowable for the organs of states, especially the accounting offices, to deviate or to vary contracts in the last quarter as would be presented. The deviation types are single source and unsolicited bid, a closed limited bid, as well as the use of request for quotations instead of a competitive bid. Contract modification types will include the extension of contract or a purchase order where there was no need to have a contract. A purchase order is sufficient as a contract. Where there was an expansion of scope in the contract or the purchase order, or where the variation of contract or the purchase order was effected. If I may go directly to the variations, Chair, we had in total 14 billion of value of contracts where deviations were effected. 98% of those were on the top 20 government institutions, and the 2% were on the rest of the other institutions. The top 20 government institutions at 14 billion, the number of applications were 64. In total, we had a number of 172 variations in the last quarter. When you look at the top 20 variation applications in value, you would note that Transnet had the majority of the variations in terms of value, followed by SARS, and then Eskom, and then the government printing works, and the Petro SA, including the correctional services, which then indicates that the majority and the bulk of the top 20 went specifically to the top five in terms of value of the deviations in the last quarter. This, if you look at the top 20 variation applications in numbers, total of 87. SARS had 9, National Treasury had 6, Eskom had 6, BBI and DEF, as well as the Public Works had 6. In that descending order. If you look at the top 20 supported and not supported deviations, members, honourable members, you would note that if you look at the graph on the value supported and not supported, 63% of the deviations that were sent through were not supported, which is quite a substantial amount or number of deviations that were not supported, with 30% that were conditionally supported, and just about 5% which were just for noting. If you look at the number of those that were supported and not supported, you would note that 28% were conditionally supported, which is about 18 variations. And you would have 27%, which is 17 in number of those that were not supported, and 16%, which is only 10 that were supported, and only 22%, which is 14 of those that were noted. If at all we have received any of the deviation requests that reside within the authority of the accounting officer, we then refer them back to the accounting officer and the authority. Only 6%, which is about 4, were referred back for the accounting officer, the accounting authority to adjudicate on and make sure that they make the decision. What this graph is indicating to us is that majority of the variations that we have received as National Treasury in the last quarter at 63% were not supported, and the 30% that we have received had the conditions attached to them. So quite a very small amount of them were outright approvals without any conditions. This is quite a busy slide. But it just indicates the positioning with regards to the slide that I have just presented. In total, 14 billion with 64 transactions that took place on the top 20. And in total, if you look at the bottom line, there's just about 172 of the deviation requests that we received from the organs of state in the last quarter, which is quite a sizable amount of deviations. Honorable Chair, we will move to the contract modifications. In the last quarter, we have received just about 162 requests for contract deviations. If I may just contextualize what deviations would be, there is an existing contract, and for some reason, there may be a change in scope, there may be a change in price, there may be a change in the duration, whatever reasons it may be that warrants a shift from the original contracted conditions. Such we would call a contract modification. 162 of them were received from organs of states, with 84 received from the top 20 government institutions. In total, 99% came from top 20 government institutions. I will share who they are in the next slide. And only just less than 1% were received from the rest of the organs of states. Eskom sent the highest in terms of value. In fact, they are a top 90% themselves in terms of the request for contract modification. SARS and Department of Health, as well as National Treasury and the Department of Basic Education, followed in that descending order. If we look in terms of numbers, you would take note, Honourable Chair, that we have CCMA at 17, even though they have a number, quite a huge number, the values are quite small. So they would not feature in the top 20%. Eskom had 15 modifications in total. SARS had 9, DBSA had 8, SA Tourism in that descending order. In total, we had 100 number of those in the top 20. If we look at the value supported and not supported pie chart, Chair, you would note that 87% of the modifications that were considered or supported by National Treasury had conditions attached to them, and outright supports were only 10%, not supported were 10%, and outright support were 3%. If you look in terms of number, we conditionally supported 47 of the modifications that we received, and 17 were not supported and 14 were outright supported, with only 4 that were noted, and we closed 2 because the organ of state did not provide us information as we were requesting. And therefore, that request for modification, we would close without giving any opinion or support. This is the high-level presentation of the modification status. Eskom, as you would note, at 31 billion with 15 counts, South African Revenue Services, at 841 million with 9 counts. In total, on the top 20, we have 33 billion at 84 counts. In total, 33 billion with 162 counts with regards to the modification requests from the organs of state with Eskom having the bulk of those modifications. The common reasons, Chair, this slide is no different from the previous ones. The same trends come through from the analysis of the slides. The sole supplier or utilization of single source is what comes. The request for closed bid processes still comes through. There's also an element of business continuity. SARS had one, Eskom had one in terms of their strategy for business continuity. There's also an increasing trend with regards to business strategy and operational strategies that are implemented in the organs of state, Eskom being one that cites such in their modification requests as well as in their deviation requests. There's also elements of service delivery where we would not want the service delivery to be hampered, and therefore we would put such conditions in place. Extensions of current contracts due to new tender process not concluded in time. Organs of states are not concluding the contracts. This is one pandemic that creeps up. Honorable Chair, honorable members, that the organs of states that do not start the procurement processes on time. As a result, it leads to them having a necessity to extend the current contract so that the service delivery continues and that there is no breakdown in terms of service provision and making sure that government works. That's one area that we will keep an eye on. Unfortunately, because of various repository systems, ERP systems, we are unable to pick up when some of these contracts are going to expire. We are hoping that organs of states, with regards to what we would expect them to report on in the new instruction, we would be able to pick up some of these and be able to manage them from a national treasury perspective. But it still remains the responsibility of the accounting officer to ensure that they invoke proper controls in their space for when contracts are going to expire and making sure that new contracts are put in place before those expire, taking into account that the supplier market at the moment have more bargaining power with regards to the procurement, and therefore starting the process would entail having negotiations with them on price and negotiations on scope, and that could take a bit of time. And accounting officers, guided by the chief financial officers as well as the adjudication committees, may have to make sure that they start the procurement processes in place and timelessly. Continue using of existing softwares. Softwares are a challenge for business continuity, and it's something that we have to look at. Moving forward, we may have to engage CETA and ensure that in terms of the software utilization in government, how do we then ensure that these licenses and softwares are managed? There's quite a number of softwares in application in government. We see those through the application for continuous or continuity of utilization of these softwares. There are also issues with regards to exceeding the 15% or the 15 million threshold, and the same as 20% and 20 million thresholds. Majority of the requests revolve around just where the scope has to be varied because it exceeds 15% in terms of contract value and 20% for the construction environment. The government-to-government procurement is also seen as an increase. National School of Governments is one area where we see government-to-government procurement taking place. GTEC, CSIR, and some other government entities, we are seeing a move towards utilization of these government entities for procurement, and we need to explore to what extent government benefits and quantify those benefits for government. But there is that move. And an expansion of scope with regards to time and material is also one of the common threats for deviations and expansions. I have spoken to that and increasing in departure from the competitive bidding processes, continuous modification. We are also seeing an increasing audit disputes. We are engaging with AGSA, and we will continue to engage with AGSA as OCPO where there are disputes. And there is a new document on dispute settling mechanisms that we are still looking at with AGSA. We are hoping that it will eliminate a number of these disputes that are going to come through, particularly with the revision of the instruction that we have just introduced from the 1st of April. Poor procurement planning is one of them I've spoken to with regards to not starting procurement timelessly, resulting in contracts being varied or expanded. Poor implementation of projects. In the last engagement, Honorable Chair, I have spoken to the fact that government does not have sound project management principles, nor has it places responsibility on any of the organs of states to manage how project management would happen in government. And that's something we would have to take as OCPO, because it migrates very nicely into procurement, and it starts to distort how procurement needs to happen. If projects are not managed properly, deviation starts to creep in and contract modification starts to creep in. But the general principle is that projects must be managed properly and they must be tracked properly using the methods and methodologies that are available out there in the market. What we are doing in our space as OCPO, we are going to implement guidance and principles on contracts management, and we will be rolling that very shortly. It is at an advanced stage. Poor governance structures. Delegation of authority documents are not clear, and even if delegation of authority documents are not clear, those that are entrusted with ensuring that approvals and sign-offs happen at the right levels within the organization must ensure that they are gatekeepers as well as the control measures to ensure that thresholds and approvals happen at the right processes or at the right levels. We still see some of those where approvals happen where they're not supposed to happen, and therefore increasing irregular expenditure within the procurement environment. Non-implementation of consequence management on officials who cause irregular expenditure. We test this with regards to the number of audit findings that AGSA has raised in a particular year, and how many the condonations that have been sent through to National Treasury with regards to that irregular expenditure. Not many condonation requests come through. Therefore, we may extrapolate that there might be lack of implementation of consequence management in those irregular expenditure findings where such consequence management needs to be taken, and therefore National Treasury is unable to deal with those if they are not sent through to us to have a look at. These are the operational challenges and remedies. They have remained consistent over time, Chair, and not present these in this meeting this morning. That concludes this part of the presentation. Chair, I will take cue from you. Would you like us to take questions and answers on these before we go to the next presentation? Please advise.
I think, colleagues, it's best let's do that, because the issues are, the other is implementation and the other is a policy matter for, you know, and I think they are quite vastly different. So colleagues, you will indicate if you would like to ask a question in the side office. I'm just checking now. Unless you can just indicate here, colleagues, if you wish to raise a question. All right. Okay, let's do this. Acting CPO, go to the next presentation, and then we will. Let's take us through the next presentation. That's fine.
We'll certainly do that, Honorable Chair.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, the next presentation would be on the prevention and combating abuse of SCM system. This is the new instruction note, 3 of 2021-22. That's an update on the provisions of the revised National Treasury SCM. We have revised instruction note 3 of 2016-17 and put together a new instruction note altogether. The new instruction note looks and makes provision for, among others, what the Constitutional Court indicated in its judgment in February, as well as the findings and the recommendations that were made by the Zondo Commission, as well as all other best practices and trends that we have picked up in the management of the deviations and modification, as well as management of all other case laws in the country as we experience them from time to time. The contents of the presentation, we would look at the reasons why the new instruction, the purpose for that instruction, as well as the various areas that were enhanced in the instruction, and what are the practice notes and circulars, as well as instructions that were repealed as a result of issuance of this new instruction. And then we will conclude at that. I think I would start, Honorable Chair, with the rationale for the revision of the instruction. In reviewing this instruction, the National Treasury, especially the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, adopted a number of principles and approaches. The first one is that we wanted to ensure that the revised instruction that does not encroach on the institutional accountability conferred upon the accounting officers and accounting authorities by the available pieces of legislation with specific reference to PFMA, which the rationale there is that the Constitutional Court has held that conduct by an organ of state that has no foundation in some law breaches the principle of legality, which is a subject of the rule of the law, a fundamental value of the Constitution. So the functionary entrusted with the regulation making power cannot stray from the parameters set by the empowering legislation. What that means is that if the Constitutional Court and the PFMA or any other pieces of legislation that already exists provide certain framework, the National Treasury may not deviate from ensuring that they overstep their authority with regards to placing additional recommendations which are not supported by the Constitution and the subordinate acts to the Constitution. Also, we should not take powers from the accounting offices and accounting authorities, but we should be seen to be making sure that the accounting offices and the accounting authorities take accountability for what they have been entrusted to do by the Constitution and the primary legislation that supports the Constitution. The second rationale is to find other legally cognizable means to get institutions to do what they must do. What we have found ourselves doing is that when organs of state are not doing what they are supposed to be doing, Honorable Chair, we wanted National Treasury to place, to take that responsibility and make sure that the organs of state do what they're supposed to do, instead of making sure that the accounting officers are accountable for making sure that PFMA's provisions are followed to the latter, and that procurement within the area of accountability happens in line with the applicable legislation that governs STM or that governs public procurement. Once again, drawing lessons from case law, the Constitutional Court have also held that if the minister is of the view that organs of state are failing to do what they are required to do, he must find other legally cognizable means to get them to do what they must do. For an example that we can place is that he might engage organs of state politically, or he could introduce a bill in Parliament with a view of amending the legislation. But the National Treasury should not take that accountability and places the accounting officers less accountable for what they are supposed to do. To this end, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer had to firstly test all inputs received when we opened the when we published the new instruction for public comment. And secondly, find legally cognizable means, which in this case was to provide for reporting requirements that would strengthen the transparency of procurement within institutions, that forcing accounting officers and authorities to be accountable because of the proverbial light would be shown on them. Really, what we're trying to do, or in this instruction note, is to send a strong message to the accounting authorities and accounting officers that you are entrusted in terms of PFMA and in terms of the provisions of the Constitution to ensure that procurement happens in the manner that is structured and in the manner that is fair, transparent, and you will take accountability for spending the money that has been made available to you or to the organ of state, and let the spotlight shine on you for not having exercised your responsibility in terms of spending government money. The amendment of the regulations under the PFMA and the development of the Public Procurement Bill may be the mechanisms that can be used to provide such opportunity for National Treasury as well as the Minister to improve efficiencies in the public procurement domain. The next rationale, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, is to bridge the disparity between government departments. What happened was the Treasury Regulation 16A excluded some of the schedules of the state-owned companies from that regulation. What we are doing now with the new instruction is to ensure that all organs of state are included in the instruction and making sure that they are particularly included to make sure that the ethical standards as well as avoidance of abuse of the SCM system is also applicable to them. To this end, the revised instruction differs somewhat from the strict format of being a directive, but has in various places provided the context for government to ensure that it does procurement efficiently. The areas where we found gaps are the general conditions of contract, standard bidding documents, and so forth, and those we have tried to close the loop on. The fourth rationale was considered the extensive inputs by stakeholders, some of which were opposed to others. Thus, the OCPO had to ensure that a balance was struck between competing interests while maintaining respective legislative mandates. We had an opposing views in terms of the inputs we have received from our public participation. Some felt that the instruction note 3/16/17 was adequate enough to provide the framework required for National Treasury to exercise its responsibility. While on the other hand, We with regards to objective number one, where National Treasury did not want to encroach into the accountability of the accounting officers as placed by the Public Finance Management Act. We have received some of the organs of states that says provide accountability to the accounting officers and let them be accountable for the procurement of goods and services in line with the PFMA and any other primary legislation supporting the Constitution. The purpose then of the revision was threefold, with the instruction providing the following measures to improve accountability and transparency in the procurement of goods and services, to reduce the abuse of the supply chain management system, and to ensure the value for money within the SCM environment. Therefore, there is a shift in focus to reporting to various accountability structures, enabling the relevant treasuries, including National Treasury, to perform its monitoring role within the confines of the prevailing legislation. So instead of National Treasury, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, being operationally involved in the organs of state, rather shift from ensuring that their accountability rests with ensuring that they perform the monitoring function, utilizing the prevailing legislative environment that exists within government. All relevant role players, including accounting officers and authorities, are enabled to operate within their mandates, within their operational as well or tactical as well as the strategic environment. One of the things that the new instruction seeks to address is issues of investigation of complaints and allegations of abuse. The instruction provides for the register to be established, maintained within the institution that deals with logging complaints and allegations of abuse of the SCM systems. We to date not have had a register of such. Now we will be, the organs of states will be required to record. The reason for this is that National Treasury would receive this and therefore manage the trends and analyze the trends and respond accordingly with regards to the gaps that may exist within the legislative environment, or to look at what would be the reasons from a behavioral point of view with regards to officials in government, or what would be the behavior with regards to the supplier behavior. Remember, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, that corruption would happen in two folds, from the official's point of view as well as from the supplier's point of view, and we would like to remedy it from both angles. Initially, the draft had included requiring a report of the allegations of abuse against the head of the relevant treasury to be sent to the executive authority to solicit opinion on how such allegations should be treated, bearing in mind that the drafting team was concerned that instruction would be overarching. What we then corrected was let the executive authority receive the report, and let the executive authority then exercise their executive authority over the reports that they receive. What that means then is that comments received from internal stakeholders also had a similar concern, and we're of the view that National Treasury cannot prescribe what an executive authority should do. And a decision was taken that the executive authority can be notified. However, it would be incumbent of the respective executive authority to take appropriate action without prescribing it in the instruction. The next one that enhancement we have done in the instruction was the treatment of disclosure and declarations. The instruction provides for institutions to identify and manage all potential conflicts of interest and other disclosures made by persons participating in the procurement processes to enable the accounting officer and the accounting authority to make informed decisions about the person participating in the SCM process. The review that OCPO performed brought to the forefront A number of inconsistencies that exist within the broader public sector legislation and the expectation that SEM prescripts resolve them. For example, non-employees of the state are barred from the public sector procurement despite the utterances in various platforms which give that impression. The Public Administration Management Act of 2014 defines employee and public service. And when reading these together, they exclude employees of state-owned companies. Therefore, it is not clear as to what basis, what legislative prescripts may SEM public procurement use to determine what an employee can and cannot do. So we have clarified that in the instruction, and therefore the SOEs are roped in the new instruction. With regards to the extension of the application, the previous standard bidding documents, 4, 8, and 9, were not applicable to Schedule 2, 3B, and 3D public entities, but the revised standard bidding 4, Document B, includes these other entities as well. So basically, when it comes to issues of disclosure and declarations, we had challenges with a definition of employee. We also had a challenge with the inclusion of some of the schedules of the public entities, especially those 2, 3B and 3Ds. We have narrowed the gap and we have closed that gap in the new instruction and made sure that they are included. The issue of restrictions of persons from conducting business with the state, during the review of the instruction of 3.16.17, OCPO established that when it comes to the restrictions of suppliers with regards to PFMA-related transgressions, there was a challenge in that the general conditions of contract was not issued with application to the Schedules 2, 3B, and 3D public entities. Hence, the vacuum in the case of these entities, as Regulation 14 of the public procurement of the PPR regulations could not apply to them. But we have closed the gap now when it comes to restriction of suppliers, and 2, 3B, and 3D are therefore included in the current instructions. And in this instruction, we have unpacked the process to follow when restricting a person in terms of PFMA. I may have to indicate to the Honourable Chair and the Honourable Members that I'm only speaking about restrictions in line with PFMA, because the regulations which also indicated restrictions were declared invalid, and we have dealt with that one in our previous deliberations. Only the suppliers may only be restricted in terms of PFMA with the invalidity of the public procurement regulations of 2017. We've also closed the gap between deviations from normal bidding processes and expansions and variations. If you could excuse me a second, Chair. My throat was getting dry and water was located far from me. Thank you very much. If I may proceed, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, what the power to approve procurement by other means, for an example, deviations from inviting competitive bids, which included or includes limited bidding. The limited bidding here is your sole source, your single source, your multiple source. We have provided that in the new instruction, and we've given the power to the accounting offices and the accounting authorities. So this power to support or not support is no longer vested in the relevant treasuries. The relevant treasuries in this instance would be the National Treasury and the Provincial Treasuries. The accounting offices and the accounting offices would have to officiate and adjudicate on the request for deviations, expansions, and variations. This is as originally intended in the PFMA when it was turned into law. The instruction provides for monthly reporting on procurement by other means to the relevant treasuries and the Auditor General of South Africa. The reporting requirement is quite stringent, and therefore we will be in the position to interrogate the information that we receive, and we will be in a position as the National Treasury interrogate the information. If there is a need for us to do an investigation into some of these deviations and variations and modifications, we will do so in line with the applicable legislative framework that National Treasury may invoke to be able to make sure that accounting officers and accounting authorities are held accountable. And the AGSA would also be in a position to utilize the reports that we will generate to probe further when they are doing their annual audits and make sure that the loop is closed and that there is no blurry area with regards to how the accounting officers and authorities have applied their authority with regards to the deviations and expansions and modifications of the contract. Moreover, so, Honourable Chair, the provision has been introduced in the instruction to further provide for reporting in the institution's annual report. So we do not want anything hidden whatsoever where procurement by other means has occurred. So the reporting in the annual report elevates the transparency of this type of procurement and reduces any element of obscurity of such transactions from not being known by public as well as the executive authority. As a result, Office of the Chief Procurement Officer will provide input to the compliance reporting framework that is currently now being issued by OAGO. Office of the Accountant General is looking at the compliance reporting framework, and certainly we will give an input into that framework and ensure that it covers all areas as we have envisaged them in this new instruction. It is believed that these reporting interventions will strengthen transparency, which was a key concern in the Zondo Commission of Inquiry into State Capture Report, here referred to as the State Capture Report. The next area that we have cemented in the new instruction is the bid committees. It should be noted, Chair and Honourable Members, that in light of the various governance in we've observed as National Treasury in the State Capture Report and took a view that it was necessary for us to emphasize the need for bid committees and to concretize the requirements. Even the SOEs who are not governed by Treasury Regulation 16A are included in this new instruction to make sure that the bid committees are given specific responsibility and that the delegation of authority documentation that speaks to the authority of various committees would then have to ensure that they speak to the new instruction and that government procurement committees are efficient and they function in line with making sure that the government purse is dispersed in the manner that is acceptable and in line with the current legislative framework. This paragraph aims to ensure that there is a system in place for the specification, evaluation, and adjudication of bids by all institutions and not just the institutions to which Chapter 16A applied. So the state, the SOEs are included in the new instruction. They have no, they cannot make their own decision on how the bid committees should function. We have prescribed for all organs of state how the bid committees should function in this new instruction note. Whilst it appears that SOEs do follow some committee system, even though they call it different names. Some of them call it a cross-functional teams. It is not clear to what extent the principle of segregation of duties and government provisions relating to bid committees has been accommodated within SOEs. We have seen in the Zondo Commission how specific bid adjudication, how bid committees have relegated their responsibilities to specific individuals resulting in the capture or irregularities that we have experienced. This provision then in the new instruction 6 or is trying to instill a principle that a bid cannot be evaluated by one person, as this opens the risk of non-compliance, abuse and corruption significantly. The specific paragraphs 341 and 342 of the state capture report, which speaks to procurement of certain projects without the participation, knowledge or approval of the business owners of those projects. So we have closed the gap with regards to functioning of the bid committees in the new instruction. There are also general requirements that are included in the instruction. The accounting office and the accounting authority may not invite price quotations or bids where no provisions has been made in the budget. Overrunning of the fiscus is something that we are trying to avoid, and we are trying to make sure that the accounting officers will be and the authorities will be held accountable for having spent the money that has not been made provisions for in the budget, specifically in that financial year and in the outer years. The accounting officers must ensure that cash flow is sufficient to meet the contractual obligations. Therefore, it needs to speak to the budget on a year-to-year basis. Must pay suppliers within the 30 days of receipt of invoices or a period provided for in the contract. We are cognizant of the fact that some of the SOEs pay within 15 days of receipt of the invoice, and some generally stick to 30 days. But generally, the principle that executive holds is that within 30 days, suppliers must be paid. We are no longer going to tolerate a situation where suppliers go insolvent because government has not paid them for goods and services that they duly qualify to be paid for, where there are no disputes that have been lodged and there hasn't been any court proceedings for the disputed invoice. That accounting offices and authority may not place orders with suppliers for goods and services to be received in the current financial year and arrange with suppliers to be invoiced and payment to be made in the next financial year. We have found instances where the contract is due to lapse in this financial year and payments is due to happen in this financial year because the organs of state do not have finance in this financial year. They delay payment and they then start spending money in the next financial year, resulting in draining of the fiscus in the next financial year. And that's something that we would like to discourage with regards to this instruction. The accounting officers and authority must also ensure that no prepayments are made prior to receipt of goods and services unless required by the contract with the supplier. Most of these provisions, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, were included simply because the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer has seen how supply chain management has been crippled with regards to non-payment of suppliers, how the non-availability of budget happens, and how procurement happens where there is no budget, where there was no procurement plan provision for procurement of some of the goods and services, and there are no compelling reasons for that deviation from the procurement plan as issued to the National Treasury should have occurred. Some of the prescripts were not applicable to 2, 3B and 3D, and we have narrowed the gap. Honorable Chair, Honorable Member, you would note that I put emphasis on Schedule 2, 3B and 3D. That's where most of the SOEs play, and we're narrowing the gap and making sure that they are included and that their procurement happens in line with the rest of the other government institutions, and that there is a consistent application of public procurement prescripts within government. There are also general comments and observations.
Just 1 second. Hi, can you? Sorry, colleagues, I'm not sure who. difficult to see who that is.
I think I've taken care of that, Chair.
Okay, clear so that good, Ben. Thanks. All right, Acting CEO,
okay.
Continue. Sure.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. There are general comments and observations. The revised instruction make provisions for reporting to the relevant treasuries and the Auditor General of South Africa, as well as in the institution's annual report. I'm addressing now what the implications would be under the general comments and observations, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. The institution of the intention of the monthly reporting to the relevant treasuries and AGSA is to ensure that where there are glaring matters of non-compliance, the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer and those equivalent units in the provincial treasuries can act on these glaring matters, and that AGSA may, in terms of Section 5, subsection 1D of the Public Audit Act, consider a special investigation or audit if the AGSA deems it to be in the public interest to do so. Basically, what we are trying to do with the reporting is to provide for transparency with the belief that early detection can assist with the intervention by National Treasury, the relevant Treasury, and the AGSA, and even lead to referral of cases to law enforcement if so desired. Instead of the AGSA and National Treasury to wait for the end of the financial year and only audit, then it may be too late and government purse may have been emptied by an incorrect application of law and by irregular application of law or corruption that takes place. Therefore, if we become proactive in terms of detecting this through the reporting, we will be in a position to curb some of the malfeasance that may occur within a specific procurement transaction. Therefore, the timeless reporting or the monthly reporting is necessary to pick up these trends. The purpose of providing for reporting in the annual report is to ensure that the public also has access to this information, as I've alluded to earlier, and it is not hidden away in an obscure report that is difficult to access or even interrogate, and to also provide for ease of reference for the structures to whom the accounting office and the accounting authorities are required to report. Most of the comments that we are receiving currently, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, to the draft public procurement bill, as well as some remarks from the state capture report, have highlighted the lack of transparency when it comes to procurement processes. And the aim of these reports is to further enhance this transparency. It is anticipated that the transparency will also help to hold accounting officers and authorities accountable for the decisions that they take as and when the incidents happen in the reporting that we would receive. Also, we have repealed a number of instructions and practice notes and circulars. There are various reasons why some of them are repealed. One could be that there was repetition in various instruction notes. Two, we have received far much better best practices, and therefore the practice at that time is no longer relevant. Three, we have learned from issues of corruption and irregular expenditure. We have also learned from the Zondo Commission and state capture issues. We have also learned from the audits and the number of findings that we receive, reports that we receive from the AGSA, and simply the procurement landscape shifts from time to time, and it requires that we introduce best practices and we avoid discourage certain behaviors and practices within government, and that has resulted in that number of long list of instruction notes and circulars repealed, and the new instruction note has covered most of the areas that were in that, and some we have just discontinued simply because they are no longer relevant. This will serve to reduce the fragmentation continuously. Also, a big win as well is that we have a number of these instruction notes that are happening. Certainly, my office seeks to ensure that for a seamless functioning of SCM, we need to reduce the number of these instruction as far as we possibly can. In this transition period, as we are putting together the public procurement bill, which will see a further reduction with the number of circulars and instruction moving forward in the SCM space. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, this concludes the presentation, and I hope we have provided the rationale for why we have revised the new instruction, clearly looking at cementing the governance monitoring that needs to happen, and how to detect fraud and fraudulent activities before they drain the fiscus and before they become a rot in government, and to partner with law enforcement agencies and specifically with AGSA to ensure that early auditing of some of these suspicious transactions could happen. But most importantly, to ensure that the accounting officers and the accounting authorities exercise their responsibility as required by the Constitution and as prescribed in the Public Finance Management Act and specifically in the municipal space, in the Municipal Finance Management Act. Thank you very much, and we may take questions from now.
Okay, thank you very much, Acting Chief Procurement Officer. Right, there's two hands that I saw. We're going to start with Ubabulisi. He's had his hand up on the, sorry, Mazaman, I didn't see you on the virtual platform. So we'll start with you, then Babu Somyo, you'll be next, and then we will get responses and then take the next set of hands after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, no, sorry, I put my hand up when I thought we were going to ask questions earlier, but I have got those questions. Thank you very much, and good morning to the presenters. Mr. Chairman, the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer was set up, and if I remember correctly, it came into existence on an interesting day, the 1st of April 2015. Those of us who were involved in drafting that legislation and many others were hopeful that the establishment of that Chief Procurement Officer, then under Kenneth Brown, would have a far-reaching impact on the levels of corruption and fraud. Sadly, that hasn't happened. Kenneth Brown left, I think, about 2 years after the establishment of the office, and we haven't had a full-time a procurement officer since then. But thank you to Mr. Fani for acting in that position. So one of the issues that faces the fight to prevent corruption and fraud is for institutions, particularly institutions like Eskom, to be light-footed and be able to move quickly. Now, if one looks at the presentation this morning, there's quite a few referrals to prior approval by the relevant Treasury. I would like to know from the acting CPO, what kind of time restrictions are there on this? I mean, how long does it take for the relevant Treasury to respond, and is this quick enough? I ask specifically because when Mr. Jahana took over as CEO of SAA, does one of the first issues he raised was the slow responses in trying to run a commercial operation like an airline. And of course, we all know he eventually threw in the towel and left. But it was also something raised again during our visits to Madupi and Kusile, in terms of being able to keep the lights on and being able to rapidly make decisions and take action. So the question really is, are there any time restraints on these approvals being given in order to ensure that services continue unabated. The other one is this question of sole source. What we found at Madupi and at Kwasile was the issue of emissions control being in itself an issue, which we won't deal with here, but the establishment of the plant being a sole source was being challenged by National Treasury, I assume, or Treasury of some sort, or the procurement office, in the sense that the supplier of the plant uses subcontractors for certain plant within the plant. And this was inhibiting the progress on modifications and maintenance of these emission control plants, which in turn, during one of the worst weeks of load shedding, caused losses in generation capacity. So the question there is the ability of National Treasury or the Procurement Office, Central Procurement Office, to find ways of getting these determinations done quickly. So on applications, but even when it comes to defining what a sole source is. Mr. Chairman, we've been shown a whole lot of applications approved, not approved, conditionally approved, and so on. Can we be told were those applications, or were some of the applications, or what number of applications were made after the fact, if any? And those that were not approved, did they proceed or did they not proceed in terms of the knowledge of the procurement office? Presumably you monitor what happens after the approval or non-approval is given, or National Treasury monitors. Mr. Chairman, I'm curious. I have a high regard for SARS, despite its capture by a certain Tom Moyane for a while. And I'm curious about the relatively large numbers of applications coming in from SARS. Because SARS, like Eskom, needs to be fleet of foot. And so when SARS was originally set up and the receiver revenue was disbanded and replaced with SARS, it was set up as outside of the public service so that decent salaries could be paid, etc. But I think the public service now, is, in terms of salary levels, has probably surpassed SARS. But what are the reasons for SARS's applications? Or give us some idea. Obviously, with the detail you can't give now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Isbabu Samuel.
Thank you very much, morning colleagues. For me, I think what the Honorable List has raised is a key aspect of the last presentation, which seeks to negate the first presentation made and the crux of referrals to treasuries for various approvals and finalization of other expansions or deviations to be finalized by the accounting officers' authorities. And my question, therefore, is the role of the procurement office in terms of the initiation of these, and mainly this the notice which has been presented to us, and to the effect that if you listen from the first presentation made, it tells the story that the justification of movement from what we have seen in terms of the quantities and the quality aspect of what we want to see in terms of service delivery, whether in terms of time, in terms of price, in terms of decisions, is a very subjective move than being an objective move. And if you would pile up such reports to us in relation to various quarters in this financial year or other financial years, would counsel the justification of the movement by Treasury to introduce the new form in as far as matters of procurement are concerned. So I fail, you see, to understand what is the key driver of seeing Treasury coming up with this latest you see publication, which sought to even weaken the ability of the state to account for matters of expenditures in terms of procurement and rightful decisions as such, because the same accounting officers which are talking about in terms of empowering on their own decisions are the same accounting officers wherein they have made referrals to yourselves, whether at the 60% against 40% value approvals, which puts us, in fact me, in the failure to understand why then do you come with these a sort of so-called improved operational mechanisms in as far as the procurement is concerned. And for me, this new approach seeks to deepen the current problems that we find in terms of irregular expenditure to be heightened at that level, and a fruitless expenditure in the similar way. What is the basic informing objective that Treasury, while they see the pileage of, if you can go to your files for such approvals that we ought to make, that you should move towards this kind of a direction. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right. Let's take the third hand for now, Honorable Mente, and then we will get responses and then take the next round of questions. Honorable Mente.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, with what Honorable Somyo has covered, with only two right now, one with the first presentation, what is it that the National Treasury has done so far to deal, not to now cap, to deal with the departments that have continued to procure and use systems that are not favorable to our procurement systems and the expenditure thereof? Wherein 63% that was not allowed continued with their procurement, and do they have any idea of was that kind of a procurement
Honorable Mente, I think we are losing you. All right. Honorable Mente?
Yeah.
Honorable Mente, we are losing you. All right, let's do this. National Treasury, please respond to the questions of Honorable Lees and Honorable Somyo. And then Sister Mpudben, please just try and get hold of Honorable Mente so that she can work on her connection, and then we'll take as soon as she's readily available for that. Let's get responses to that. Honorable Nkonto, you'll be first in line in the next round of questions. Right, National Treasury?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. If I may respond to Honorable Lees, when we received in the past using Instruction Note 3/16/17, where National Treasury was required to support or not support, depending on the circumstances applicable to the application that was sent through, it is generally accepted or expected by the organs of state that National Treasury, based on what would be submitted at that time, to apply their mind and support or not support. There has been instances where National Treasury requested additional information because there were blurry areas that National Treasury needed to make sure that the areas are covered before we actually voice our opinion with regards to supporting or not supporting of the deviations or the modifications that were sent to National Treasury. That has resulted in some of the applications that were sent through prolonged, where National Treasury was, number one, maybe awaiting information. Number two, the information provided was irrelevant and inconclusive. Or number three, the organs of state have not submitted that information. Number four would be there would be instances where internal to add to National Treasury, we need to have a conversation. For an example, where public finance has to indicate what would be the financial risks of approving such a deviation, or where the oversight or the division that plays an oversight responsibility on SOEs would also have to pronounce on that application. So an application would vary from time to time. Honorable Lees has indicated that there were sole sources or sole supply applications that were sent to National Treasury. The Instruction Note 3/16/17 was very specific that in instances where a sole supplier or the organ of states wants to use a sole supplier, the accounting officer had the authority to approve such a supplier. There was no need for anybody to bring anything to National Treasury or any application for a supplier for sole source. There has been quite a number of statements made by ESCOM specifically that National Treasury takes too long and wants to approve the sole suppliers. That is not correct. Sole suppliers were delegated to the accounting offices to adjudicate on. National Treasury intervention was not required and still is not required. Where we have received an application for a single source, we adjudicated that as such. If we have received in the past an application for a single source, but in our opinion and based on the information at our disposal, that it was a sole supplier, we have referred that back to the accounting officer to adjudicate and make his decision and apply. All the matters that we officiated on and we have formulated our opinion, whether it's a single or not, single source or not, we have given reasons why we have indicated our support or not supported in that instance. Honorable Lees, we have tried as far as we possibly can to process these, and we have reduced the time considerably, but the volume of work that we have received for the deviations is probably one of the secondary reasons why we have also considered making sure that instead of National Treasury with limited operational knowledge of what's happening in the organs of state, and with only one functionary that is technically qualified to interrogate the technical reports that we have received. Therefore, it was one of the secondary reasons why we said the move now to ensure that the accounting officers make the places that the instructional must place an accountability to the accounting officers should happen, and it should happen now. One of the other questions that Honorable Lees asked is he would have wanted an indication of which of the requests for deviation and modification happened after the fact. If such happened after the fact, our response as National Treasury would have been National Treasury does not support such a modification or deviation because it happens after the fact. We would have captured those under the not supported request for deviations and modification in our presentation. Before I give Dr. Manyati, who's standing in for Ms. Basani Dekers in governance and monitoring area, Ms. Dekker has bereavement in the family, to respond to SARS. Let me respond to Honorable Somia and Honorable Mente. I think in our presentation, Honorable Somia, we have given the reasons why we had wanted that a new instruction be issued. And I think what we want to do is to ensure that what Honorable Lees has spoken to as well, that organs of states timelessly and speedily respond to their emergencies and respond to their operational requirements, making sure that the accounting officer takes an appropriate decision and is held accountable for the decisions that they take and their accounts to their relevant executive with regards to the decisions that they have taken. The move to have National Treasury to place a word on whether something is single source or not has been as a secondary reason for the introduction of the new instruction note, given reason why it was important as well that the accounting officers take accountability. The PFMA on its own indicates that what the accounting officers can do. What we have also indicated is that the accounting officers manages money. They are provided the budget that they're supposed to work with, and they are using procurement as one of the mechanisms to spend the money that has been disbursed to them. And therefore, we would like National Treasury to provide a framework under which the accounting officers would exercise their responsibility when they disburse of that amount of money that is allocated to them, and that they are held accountable with regards to their compliance and non-compliance to these procurement transactions that they would have approved. Honorable Mente asks, what has National Treasury done so far to deal with organs of state that procure irregularly? The responsibility and holding the accounting officers accountable rests with the accounting authorities, and it rests with the executive. What National Treasury does is to follow up with regards to all the audit findings through our condemnation processes to make sure that all the deficiencies that happen in the process of taking the decisions that led into irregularities have been rooted out, and all the officials that should be held accountable for the irregular procurement have been brought to book with regards to the irregular expenditure framework that we apply for all the irregular expenditure. I must add also that the internal audit processes, as well the audit committees, are supposed to make sure that all the irregular expenditure or the audit findings that have been raised by the AGSA are followed through, and that the corrective actions have been put in place even before they come for a condonation process with National Treasury, to make sure that the sound processes and that the accounting officer signs off on after he or she has made sure that he has made certain that the control measures are put in place. But the executive authority must ensure that they take appropriate action with regards to the accounting offices and the accounting authorities that have not exercised their authority appropriately, and that has led into irregularity in the procurement processes. Dr. Manyati, if you may come in to speak on the matter of SARS that was raised by Honorable Lees, if you allow, Honorable Chair.
No, that's fine. As he does that, Acting CEO, please take down the presentation. Right, Dr. Manyati.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fani. I just want to indicate, thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members. The issue of SARS also surprised many of us in terms of taking a number two spot, which was not normal for SARS. But upon our analysis, it was indicated that the issue of SARS jumping to number two, it had mainly, amongst other things, has to do with the ICT systems for tax collection. So with other words, they wanted to improve the ICT systems that relate to tax collection. So that's mainly on the expansion side. But on the, while we are still on the expansion too, there are several items that were indicated by SARS. For example, the renewal of the internal broadview vulnerable services. So they had a contract there, but it had to be expanded because they needed to extend in terms of their lease agreement, office lease agreement. And there was also a network carrier infrastructure services that relates to the ICT modernization of tax collection, and also the issue of legal services. They had legal services that were incurred, so those cases had to be extended because the lawyers that were dealing with some of the actions or some of the cases that were extended. You know, in South Africa, some of the court cases can go on and on. So in that case, then the extensions were required. So that is in terms of the expansions. Even though on the expansions, and it amounted to 841 million as their number two from Eskom of 31 billion. Out of that 841 million, we did not support 4 million, we did not support 44 million, we did not support 115 million. So that indicates that a bulk of the applications out of these 841 were not supported, with only one that was conditionally supported, which was 90 million, and then the rest were then supported, which is four, amounting to 2,468,112 million, and then four. Also 4 million. So basically, that those were the reasons why we had expansions, Eskom jumping to number two, which was not normal. And on the side of the deviations, similar cases were noted there. SARS, we know that SARS do have sniffer dogs where they need to enforce law, SARS law. So they had a huge contract there that they wanted to deviate in order to get the veterinary services to service their dogs that they are using in their investigations. And majority of the deviations also included the residential accommodation in the areas of Manguzi, Osi Bay, Northern KZN, because those areas where basically don't have any official like flats in the big cities. It's a rural area, so if you get an accommodation, you just have to go with that accommodation. So hence, it amounted to be a deviation. Majority of them were residential areas in terms of deviations. And then there was also the issue of sale of generators from the SARS revenue building in Benoni. that also created the issue of the deviation, and that amounted to 438,000. And we supported that one. And another one that might also have a big impact that we conditionally approved that amounted to 2.3 billion was the issue of a business flow chart within SARS. So it has to do with the tax registration, tax audit, bank details changes, and there are many issues that relate to tax collection. So that is within the SARS main the core function. So we supported that on conditions. We did put some conditions there. That was the only one that was supported on conditions. And there are various others that has to do with the lease agreements and the Deben office of SARS had to do with the forklifts and, I mean, the lease and so on. So there are many, and the OR Tambo SARS office, they also had the issue of unarmed guarding services, and of which those were supported, and they amounted to 5 million. The other one amounted to 1 million, 1.6 million. So basically, in the nutshell, SARS moved to number two spot because of those peculiar conditions, and majority of those were not supported, followed by those that we supported, but with conditions. So thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think I will park there for now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Doctor. Right, Honorable Mente, is your connection fine? If not, let's go to Honorable Mkonto, and then we'll take the... Just assist me here with the... Okay, no, never mind. Let me do that. Let's do it. Right, Honorable Mkonto, Honorable Liz, is that a new hand or is it a historic hand?
Hand, Chair.
Hand, okay, no, it's fine, I'll note that. Let's take Honorable Mkonto, no problem.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning to you, Honorable Members and colleagues from the National Treasury. Chair, I hope I'm not going to, as we are discussing deviations today, I hope with my first question, I'm not deviating from the point of discussion. Chair, there is an entity in the Department of Employment and Labor called Supported Employment Enterprises, SEEs. My question is, first of all, is the National Treasury aware of the existence of that entity? And its key performance area being that of employment of people living with disabilities. Chair, they are complaining a lot that the procurement policies subject them in competing with well-established businesses, hence their existence is very compromised, Chair. We might lose those entities, and that will be a big blow when it comes to the plan to employ people with disabilities in government. Chair, my second question will be the issue of the CCMA with regard to the contract modification and application. I'm looking at the amount, the value of that, and knowing the annual budget of CCMA, it looks like almost all their budget goes to a modification. So I'm checking, Chair, if details of that can be available. My third and last question, Chair, is the issue of the register of the abuse of SCM system. According to the presentation, that is in the hands of the executive committee. They are just notified and no instruction is given to them. Fair enough. But then I want to know if there are any follow-ups. And if this chair is talking about disclosure by the officials responsible, does it has anything to do with public servants that are doing business with government? And if that is only given back to the executive to deal with it, are there any follow-ups by the Treasury to make sure that the executives responsible, they do execute consequence management? Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you much. I'm going to write. Let Honourable Liz just stand by 1 second. Honourable Mente is back, so she can just complete what she was saying. She saw that problem, and then when she's done, you will come in, Honourable Liz. Right, Honourable Mente?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I hope the network does not deal with me now. Chair, my question earlier was, given the fact that there is a high level of non-compliance with the Treasury instructions and regulations, wherein people, even when they are not supported, they go ahead with procuring whatever they want to procure. And in many cases, it results to a very fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Now, my question is, does the National Treasury have the details of these different departments? And what is it that they are doing to deal with this particular case? Because if you look at the land bank, DEH, ET, and you look at the land bank, let me make an example with the land bank. When we undertook oversight the previous week, Land Bank was visited by the Standing Committee of Finance and was established that it is bankrupt. It continued to procure whatever services it was procuring and borrowed people money whom they did not return any of those money. And therefore, there is no value for money on anything that they have done. So what has National Treasury done to deal with such cases where people continue to ignore what National Treasury is saying and it ends up with no fruitful result? It ends up with a fruitless result. Then number two, there is a situation where service providers and in municipalities, I just dealt with one of the municipalities where consultants come back to bid for more work from the municipality. Yet they are in the database of the municipality and they have been given work with that particular municipality and have not delivered. But when the bid committee sees with the new list of which consultants must come in, the very same consultant will score very high, giving them an opportunity to come back to the municipality and be given some more work. How are you dealing with that area? Because this is the same case that which SIU is dealing with now with the Bay Bridge. A service provider that comes in, does a shoddy job, but continues to receive more work and being paid. And National Treasury does nothing about such kind of areas. And we want to check, how do you then curb this kind of a situation? We cannot have a consultant in a municipality which fails to deliver, requires the municipality to pay it, even when it has not met its timeline, it has not met its deadline. Yet, when it comes to the new bidding season. They come in, they bid, they score high points because they've got all the equipment, they've got all the expertise, yet they are not doing what is supposed to be done. Thank you very much.
Okay, Honorable Liz. Thanks, Honorable Mente.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thanks for the responses received. Just want some clarity on the one, and that's the issue of after the fact applications, and then they're not supported. The question then is, were there such applications? So in that category of not supported, which has been given to us, were there such applications? And then what action is taken? What happens? Do they just simply get not supported and then left to the Auditor General to deal with? Mr. Chairman, the one question I missed just now, which I think is quite important, one of the key aspects of the establishment of the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer was the central supplier database that was going to be established, and as I understand it, it has been established. I'm wondering whether it's kept up to date, and how effective it has been in being used nationally by all the government entities and SOEs. And then just thank you for the response on SARS. It's encouraging to note that it seems to be under control. I'm curious that there was one issue was the sale of generators at the SARS Benoni office. Wasn't a big amount, 438,000 rand. But what was the application for? Because why I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, is we've got the sale of the national airline, which apparently didn't need national treasury concurrence or anything. But here we have some generators, relatively small amount, needing national treasury approval of some sort. I'm curious as to how that works. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Thank you very much. Let's get responses to that, National Treasury.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Maybe let me just start with Honorable Lees, because the questions are fresh in my head. The CSD is the central supplier database is kept fresh all the time. Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, you would note that the central supplier database interfaces with some of the databases in government. For an example, the tax matters of suppliers are kept fresh because it interfaces with SARS. The banking matters of suppliers are kept fresh because it would generate exception reports based on the banking details. So it is relatively fresh. Where suppliers register and there's no activity that happens, unfortunately, we cannot delimit the suppliers. They still need to be on the database so that when the quotations are sought, and the organs of state filter based on the services that they require, they may be able to pick up these suppliers, and maybe their chance of being included in the quotation system are much more higher than if they are rendered inactive and they have to reapply again. So no supplier is dropped unless indicated otherwise by a legal means. But the CSD itself is kept fresh. And it's updated on frequent basis by the service provider that we have, and there are numerous enhancements that we implement when we do pick up issues. For an example, there was an issue with regards to the suppliers that get blacklisted and they go and open a new supplier, a new company at Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. The CSD assists government because the ID numbers of the directors are blacklisted, and therefore that information has to be the latest information and has to be updated at all given times, and we do that certainly. The issue of supported and not supported, when we do flag a submission that is sent through and that it is not supported, we then flag it as a submission that we need to follow up depending on the impact of that submission to government. There are a number of those that we have flagged. For an example, the issue of coal supply at Eskom, there was a submission sent which we did not support, and therefore we flag that and we requested specific reporting to happen to National Treasury from the accounting officer. And it's just one example of those that we did not support and we follow through. Any request for deviation or modification or variation that has been not supported, we do flag the Office of the Auditor General so that when they do their audits, they may pick that up. What we are trying to do now with the new instruction is to pick up such trends with regards to the not supported and who has submitted those that are not supported. And jointly with AGSA, we will be in a position to identify the risks and put together the interventions to make sure that the risk is the impact of the risk is minimized for first the fiscus as well as for government with regards to the service delivery. Certainly, we don't leave them just like that. If I may go to Honourable Mentor's requests. Where I have just spoken to that one now, and when I responded to Honourable Lee's request, where we do not support, certainly we flag the risky ones, and we definitely do follow them through. We do not let them go through. In some instances, we have asked what the action plan would be for the organ of state now that we have not supported, and they need to indicate to us. With regards to that, I may concede that there has been one or two instances where organs of state have flatly did not respond to our request, and as such, we have flagged that as a possible audit finding, and we will definitely follow it through and make sure that the accounting officer is accountable for having taken a decision that has not been supported. And they should be accountable to the AGSA and to the executive authority for having implemented a decision that has not been supported. But at the end of the day, National Treasury's responsibility is to support or not support. The accounting officer is ultimately accountable for the implementation of a wrong decision, and he must be taken to task for having done that. The land bank issue... there's two divisions that are involved with regards to this. That's the public finance that manages finances of organs of state. The Office of the Chief Procurement Officer is to ensure that procurement happens in a manner that is allowable by the legislative environment. You will note that in the new instruction, we have been deliberate by indicating that the accounting officer and the accounting officer must ensure that there is budget, and they must ensure that they are accountable for having spent the money that is not being budgeted for. The current instruction note was not that explicit with regards to that, but the current one now is. How we will be able to manage this from our side is to take all the deviations and modifications that do not appear on the procurement plan that is issued to government, and they would, the accounting officer would then have to explain how come that he has procured any goods and services that do not appear on the procurement plan, and how they have reprioritized their finances or their budgets to ensure that that procurement comes through. And we will then work hand in hand with public finance with regards to making sure that the information provided to us marries what they have at their disposal with regards to spending patterns of that organs of state. So we are looking at making sure that there is a marriage between public finance and procurement, and how we will bring the two together with regards to the new instruction, holding the accounting officer accountable for having spent what they what has not been budgeted for. The issue of consultants that bid for more work when there has been non-performance. National Treasury invokes the provision of the PFMA with regards to restriction of suppliers. The organs of states must notify National Treasury for any non-performance that happens, and they must notify National Treasury what they intend to do with the non-performance of the supplier. If one of the treatments that they want to invoke with regards to non-performance is restriction of the supplier, National Treasury would then seek them to follow through the provisions given with, in line with the PFMA and in line with the new instruction and in line with the old instruction and the invalidated regulations. So the onus is really on the organs of states to inform National Treasury of non-performance and whether the supplier cannot be rehabilitated, or whether the supplier should not follow through, should not be put through a process of making sure that they understand some of the principles. For an example, if their budgeting and management of their finance is not okay, would an intervention by the small business Department of Small Business not be sufficient to assist them with regards to that? Or is this absolute non-performance, and whether the supplier should be restricted, and what would be the conditions for restriction of supplier? We do have mechanisms to do that, but National Treasury has to have that information submitted to them. We have a thousands and thousands of suppliers doing business with government at any given time. And because we do not have one single repository technology to manage supplier performance, therefore, reliance on the accounting officers to inform National Treasury where there is such is quite important, and we will continue to lobby those organs of state with regards to non-performance. Where the supplier has entered into an environment where they have transgressed issues or some of their procurement. In the last engagement that we had with SCOA, we have indicated that we will work very close with the Hawks and all other law enforcement agencies. Subsequent to that, we have started working quite close, even with the Office of the Presidency, with making sure that restriction of suppliers, based on whatever reasons, is followed through, either from the end of the accounting officer or the end of the law enforcement agencies. Such a list is provided to National Treasury, and National Treasury will then use that list to follow through issues that may have been picked up from the law enforcement agencies. But we rely heavily, like I've said, Honorable Mente, to the accounting officers to provide that information to us, and we will interrogate that information and work through with it. Honorable Konto has asked whether we are aware of the SEE within the Department of Labor, Employment and Labor, or Labor and Employment, rather. Yes, we are aware that they exist. Do we support? In principle, yes, we do. However, there is no legislative framework at the moment that allows organs of state to set aside procurement for certain designated groups. unless otherwise indicated by any primary law or subsequent instructions or regulations. What we are trying to do, or what we are going to do with the new public procurement bill, is to ensure that we are explicit with regards to support for women, support for youth, support for people with disabilities, and support for any other designated groups, specifically, when we look at what apartheid has done and how we wanted and envisaged procurement to be a lever with regards to transformation in the broader society. Therefore, for now, all we have to do is to make sure that the BBBEE provisions are carried through as legislated, and that the new public procurement bill will address some of the issues that the current legislative environment cannot deal with. One of them is set aside, and setting aside procurement for certain designated groups is certainly one of the things that we are looking at in the new dispensation. The issue of disclosure, doing business with government. The first disclosure that needs to happen is the annual disclosure, where organs of where the officials and employees of government must disclose if they are doing business with government. And therefore, we would take that information and we will ensure that such suppliers are flagged and such individuals are discouraged from doing business or taking part in activities or in leadership or directorship in companies that do business with government. And secondly, where there has been violation of such a disclosure by officials of government, we will certainly indicate and flag that. All organs of state are supposed to go into PERSAL and PERSOL and all other employee-related databases to ensure that they pick up any suppliers that has officials that work with employees of government. The central supplier database, Honorable Lees, if I may speak to that as well, on continuous basis also speaks to PERSAL and PERSOL and all other databases that we can link with to pick up any employees that are registered as directors in companies, and making sure that they are flagged, and such a supplier would not be able to be picked up and do business with government until such a directorship has been sorted out and such an employee has been deregistered as a director within the CSD space. However, we do have limitations. Any organs of states that whose databases are not, or employee databases are not linked to CSD, we may not be able to pick them up. However, such a disclosure is required by suppliers, and one of our standard bidding documents requires of potential bidders to disclose if any of the directors are employees of state, and such a disclosure is taken seriously, and we deal with when we adjudicate the tenders that we receive. I would allow Dr. Manyati to speak to the CCMA matters that are asked by Honorable Mukonto, and also maybe to touch on the SARS generator matter, if you would allow, Honorable Chair.
No, that's fine.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Just to give details on the issue that relates to SARS generator and also the CCMA matter. On the SARS generator, basically, just to give a background, the SARS was using the building in Benoni, and they then decided, based on the conditions of the lease agreement and so on, that they are leaving the building. So since they were leaving the building, they had industrial generators, the huge generators that they were using there for various purposes. If there's no electricity, they can use them and so on. So since they are industrial generators, it is costly and it is it needs special transportation measures when you move from one building to another. And if you move to another, that building must be suitable and be ready to accommodate those industrial generators. So SARS then proposed or decided to sell such the generators to the landlord, the owner of the building in this case, who then bought them. So to avoid having to incur costs of moving the industrial generators to another building or to keep them in SARS head office, because maybe if the Benoni office is no longer going to be operational anymore or moving to any other place. So it was best to sell these generators to save on the cost of moving them out and maybe getting damaged along the way and so on and so on. So basically that was the reason why SARS thought they would then come and ask for that permission based on the reasons that they are decommissioning that building in Benoni. So they won't need those generators anymore. Then they decided to sell to the landlord. On the issue of CCMA, through you, Chair, 17 applications were contained in terms of this 70 million of CCMA application. It is well agreed with the Honourable Member to say the amount that was applied here is almost equal to the annual budget of the CCMA as it is keeping on going down on an annual basis. But the 17 applications were basically, 15 of them were about the lease agreements and two were about the cleaning services in the East London office and Rustenburg office. These are expansions. So we supported those two cleaning services for East London office and Rustenburg office. The 15 lease agreements, which is the bulk of this 70 million, it was also the lease agreements. Some of the lease agreements are in the areas where it is remote. I indicated earlier on about the SARS lease agreement, where they leased in the areas of Mangosi and where it is not possible to get office accommodation anyhow. You only have one building in that small town, so you just have to go there and extend the contract or ask for favorable conditions of signing a new lease agreement and so on. So there were 15 lease agreements that were extended and 6 were not supported, meaning that we told CCMA to go back to the market and test the market. So such applications might be, for example, if they want a lease the extension in Johannesburg, city of Johannesburg or city of Tswane or city of Cape Town, you hardly run out of office spaces there. You can, but you can always advertise because there are many potential property owners there. So there was no need for them to extend such contracts or such lease agreements. So that's the reason why we did not support it. The other nine to make it 15, we supported them. So that 9 is amongst the lease agreements that are situated in rural areas or in the towns where the properties are not developed as such to have plenty of available lease agreements and some other conditions that they put there. But 6 were not supported out of the 17, and we supported the cleaning services of the East London and Rustenburg contracts. So that totals to 17 applications that came from CCMA. We fully agree that it's a high amount in terms of looking at the institution. It is a small institution in terms of budget that is allocated to it, but that's what we received. 70 million accounted for 17 applications. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Okay. Right. Colleagues, I'm not sure if there are any further questions.
Yes, Chair.
All right, Honorable Mente.
Yes, Chairperson, I'm not comfortable with the response. Can there be a clear indication of what method does head treasury have to track the databases in government, those that are in the operation space? I get the answer that there's thousands of them in the database. That's fine. But the moment a service provider receives work and get paid for that work, there ought to be a tool of monitoring, not by the municipality or by the department only, a tool that also informs the national treasurer in a mandatory form, whether quarterly or monthly, out of the service providers you have, what are their statuses in terms of service delivery and payments thereof? Because we get service providers who do not deliver, and then we get prices inflated, or we get these service providers demanding more money to be paid because there was under quotation of whatever, and the prices have changed and all of those things. But we don't get a comfort from National Treasury that there is a proper tracker. Because all of these procurement areas and all of these services that are procured, even when they are not supported, and when they are just flagged and left for Auditor General to look into them, then we are running a risk of everyone else not doing anything. And we cannot rely on officials, accounting officials and accounting authorities in other cases, to report these out of their own willingness. In the spaces of municipalities, we know the politics that are at play. We know the kind of corruption that is there. So if ever majority says no, we're not reporting this in the municipal sitting. If a council sitting does not adopt a report, it therefore means that National Treasury does not know what's happening. There should be a tracker of the National Treasury, which is mandatory, that all municipalities, you have 10 service providers. You have requested 1 billion rand from National Treasury. What's the status quo? These are the time frames. In 3 years, the project is supposed to be finished. But on the fourth year, National Treasury is not aware of what's happening. Yet there is a new request. National Treasury does not support. But when they continue to pay that same service provider, the National Treasury just flags. I'm not comfortable. Say, I need a clear explanation. And if there is no proper tractor in place, when is it going to be in place? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Well, let's get a response to that, and then there'll be just one final question on my side. National Treasury.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think in one of the discussions that we had with the committee, with the subcommittee, we have indicated that one of the enabling environments is technology, and that government at the moment has various procurement systems that they are using, electronic procurement systems that they are using. And one of the objectives of putting together IFMS was and still is to ensure that all government procurement happens under one umbrella, and all other functions that are of generic nature or that cuts across all organs of state within ambit of IFMS. And this would have assisted us quite extensively with making sure that all the procurement transactions are tracked. We can draw the exception reports, and we can customize the reports that we require in order for us to do monitoring and ensuring compliance on a continuous basis. But in the absence of such an integrated system, we rely heavily on accounting offices to ensure that their existing governance structures do work. Within organs of state, we've got an internal audit function, and the internal audit function's responsibility is to ensure and manage the risks that may result in an audit environment. They audit the financials, they audit procurement, they audit all aspects, and they've got the risk register, which indicates what are the risks and what are the risks pertaining to procurement, and ensure that there are control measures in place. We cannot emphasize the importance of an audit function within an organ of state, and ensuring that chief audit officers exercise their accountability and making sure that risks are detected and risks are mitigated. But with also another governance structure that exists, to make sure that there's no financial overruns, to make sure that organs of state procure in line with their budget, and to make sure that procurement happens in line, is the audit committees. What National Treasury seeks to emphasize is that the audit committees are meeting on a frequent basis, and they're looking at their financials. Their primary responsibility is to ensure that there is no fiscus overrun, and that in instances where there has been an excessive over expenditure is dealt with before it even becomes an apparent issue at the national space where National Treasury detects it. We are unable, like I've said, with the lack of technology that we have in government at the moment to detect these things. But certainly at the coal face, the internal audit, the audit committees are able to do that. There is bid adjudication committees in the council that exercise an oversight responsibility and approves the procurement transactions. They should be asking the pertinent questions with regards to the bid specification, SBD documents, supplier bid documents, where we have asked pertinent questions, and also they need to have a check sheet and controls with regards to where the account, the CFO is accountable to ensure that no procurement or publication of tenders for goods and services takes place where there is no budget. The CFOs know that, and they are not supposed to sanction any publication of tenders where there is no budget allocated or where they have not reprioritized their budgets to ensure that that procurement activity is catered for within the environment that they have. That responsibility rests with the CFO within a and the organ of state, and making sure that the accounting officer also would not sign for any award of tenders where there has not been any budget allocated or where the supplier has not been performing. There are mechanisms in place to make sure that National Treasury does not have to get involved in the operations and the detection. Even in the absence of the detection through a technology, those gatekeepers and those mechanisms are put in place with regards to the current legislative environment to make sure that government carries procurement in a sound, organized and coordinated manner. And I would like us to emphasize the importance of the internal audits, the emphasis of internal the audit committees in combating corruption and misuse of finances within the organs of state. And certainly National Treasury cannot distance themselves. The public finance division within National Treasury have a scrutiny of the finances, and they definitely do take up instances where there has been an over expenditure and without reprioritization in the organ of state, either at that activity level or at a cluster level where you're looking at clusters such as your economic cluster or your security cluster or your health cluster, where we're looking at the overrun of expenditure in that environment. What we are doing from our side is we will intensify our monitoring and governance in terms of the procurement plans that we require on at the beginning of the year, and making sure that all the tenders that are published on e-tender, we will make e-tender publication marry the procurement plans, so that any spikes with regards to a tender that is published where it is has not been part of the published procurement plan, we will then require explanation from the accounting officers and remedy that situation accordingly, and flag the public finance division within National Treasury of an imminent expenditure where reprioritization or reallocation has not taken place accordingly. So we do have those that we have in place, and we would like those to be fully functional to make sure that government works. Thanks.
All right, thank you very much, Acting CPO. Just one or two, three things from me. The committee has repeatedly expressed its fundamental concern about the normalization of expansions and deviations as opposed to them being an exception in the procurement processes of government. And National Treasury has acted as a fundamental element of check and balance to ensure that we push back on the frontiers of abuse, and at times a very lazy outlook towards procurement insofar as due diligence is concerned. Now, having said that, and of course there is an increase in expansions and deviations, fruitless, wasteful, and irregular expenditure, we remain therefore with heightened concern in this regard. Why do I get the senses though, now, that National Treasury is sort of shaking off this responsibility and sending it back to the problematic operational spaces, which is the various departments and entities, leaving them to their own devices with what I can only call very little safeguards and checks and balances from what I've heard and what I've been reading? Because I don't see why there is now a need to fix what is not broken. The checks and balances that you had in place, so at the very least at a conceptual modus operandi level, was fine. What you had to improve upon is your own agility and turnaround time to respond to departments and entities on issues that they had presented. It's the very same people who are not giving you adequate information, whom you have turned down at times, whom are now going to be left to their own devices to do these things. So I'm really just worried that National Treasury is engaged in what I can probably characterize as a regressive policy step in this regard. That's the first part. The second part, the extent of the consultation that you did, how far did that go? So that we can, and who did you consult on these very pertinent changes that you have made? Because I think I go back to where I started. The fundamental issue is you are dealing with increased expansions and deviations. And I think there's one policy matter we still need to deal with, and it's coming next week, the disposal of assets, as Honorable Lee was saying. So I think we sort of are not on the same page here. I'm not sure what really would have motivated to the extent to which that such a major shift takes place. Whereas we know that this is a problematic element in any case in procurement, and that we were relying on National Treasury to be a safeguard, notwithstanding the limitations which may have existed insofar as agility, turnaround time, and so on. But as a fundamental principle, and I think what I really would want National Treasury to submit to us as well is the SWOT analysis of this change, the inherent risks that are now involved in it, the threats in particular to this. And I really want National Treasury to take us along as to why. I think that is the critical question. Because I really see it as taking us some few steps backwards. National Treasury?
Thanks, Chair. I think the debate that the concern that you have is probably the concern that we had. with regards to we have been able to analyze the data that we've got and the trends that we've picked up with regards to the number of submissions that we have not supported and the number of submissions that we have indicated with conditions. But the primary question that still remained was the PFMA requires that the accounting officers be empowered to make the decisions that National Treasury is making or is advising them on with regards to the support or the non-support with regards to their procurement. And I think one of the things that we need to intensify and to make sure that happens is that when an accounting officer has made a correct decision, they must be rewarded. And where the accounting officer has made an incorrect and horrific decision with regards to the application of the deviation and modification, appropriate action needs to be taken to make sure that such a behavior does not become perpetual within government. What we also wanted to do was to enable operations to take place at the pace that they want to take place. One of the concerns that we had was if we have a continuous comments that indicates to us that the speedy decisions are required with regards to deviations and modification at a pace that would satisfy the accounting officers and especially the accounting officers that have to take up market opportunities, your Transnet, your SAAs, your ESCOMs, that have to take up market opportunities where they have to bid for goods and services from the market. Transnet has to compete with road transportation, and therefore their readiness to take up the markets without having to come to National Treasury to ask for a deviation process is required. However, it is required of the CEO of Transnet to be in a position to apply a mine and to make sure that all the balances and checks are taken and they are accountable for the decision that they have taken. And if such procurement is irregular, to be accountable for that irregular expenditure that takes place. National Treasury, on the other side, needs to ensure that they intensify the monitoring of the procurement that happens, especially in the high-risk environments, such as those that I have alluded to, and making sure that that periodic reporting is analyzed and that organs of state would be requested to supply supporting documentation for those decisions that they've taken. The National Treasury expresses its opinion on whether such a deviation or modification was warranted or is justified, and jointly agree on a mechanism to remedy the situation if already implemented and has led into irregularity. Government has to work, and National Treasury has limited resources in most of these deviations that come through, and we would like to ensure that operations happen and that government is not rendered inoperative by National Treasury and that accountability rests with the accounting officers. Honorable Chair, honorable members, should the trends indicate otherwise moving forward, National Treasury would not hesitate to issue a new instruction note to remedy the situation. We are hoping that the interventions we've put in place will ensure that the trends will come downwards and that the Auditor General would not pick up a number of irregular expenditure on their site or irregular contracts, and that we will engage National Auditor General with regards to treatment of procurement in instances where some of the irregular expenditure would have been avoided if the framework was worded or applied differently. And those conversations with Auditor General are ongoing with regards to how are we then, should there be a spike with irregular expenditure, are going to deal with issues of irregularity and auditing in that space. That's my submission to you, Chair, to you, honourable members, pertaining to the questions the honourable chair posed to all CPO. Thank you.
Yeah, but CPO, you see, we are landed with a situation where we're going back to where we were. You see, this the instruction note 3, amongst others, was a response to what you are saying now, to say in the event that there's an increase and so on. You are settled with a situation where you yourselves as National Treasury were concerned about the lack of due diligence, just one element, insofar as some of the requests that you were receiving were concerned. And now you're handing it back to the very people who were culprits. I'm not sure how logically that is, because I would have imagined that if the question was about capacity, the National Treasury must build up the capacity at National Treasury to ensure that the safeguards are put in place and that the agility and speed and turnaround time are in place. So we are experimenting now with something that we already know. We know what happened when this eventuality arose. ESCOM, amongst others, you know, so I must say that from where I'm seated, I just think that National Treasury is taking the easy route, because the implications of this now, amongst others, unless I'm wrong, is that change of scope is in contracts, is a heightened reality in this regard, and that the check and balance of ensuring that your APPs across the government spectrum and SOE spectrum are really not going to be as tight as we would have because this opens the doorway for changes. I don't get how, if I'm saying I want to expand a contract and National Treasury says, no, don't expand that contract, or I want to deviate from a particular process and say that there's a sole supplier, amongst others, and National Treasury has said on occasion, no, you have not tested the market and so on and so forth. Who does the check and balance that National Treasury was doing now? And now the very people who have been doing that, it's not as if we have not seen an escalation in the request for expansions and deviations over the past few years. We have. And I can tell you now that there's going to be even a major increase now when it's actually in the hands of those who have requested. I don't get why National Treasury didn't build up capacity. As I'm saying, I think National Treasury is shaking off a responsibility here. The whole thing sits very uncomfortable. It makes oversight and accountability even more difficult and complex. It was very easy to zoom in on National Treasury coming before us, amongst others, presenting what they had received and the reasons they had not, and then be able to proceed to the other departments. But it's fine. I think we will assess this moving forward. But I think National Treasury must consider very, very strongly that we've been down this road before, and the preventative measures or the restrictive measures that were in place have now literally just been thrown out the window. It's a very slippery slope that National Treasury is setting us on. If National Treasury doesn't have the capacity, imagine the extent of the lack of capacity in the spaces where this is being taken. I don't think this was thought through from the other perspective, and I think it's regrettable that we were we're now being informed about it and we're not consulted about it. But it's fine. I think we've heard it, and we will see how it goes. But Babu Swami, I'm suspecting that you, I'm just checking here. Babu Swami, I think you...
Yes, Chair. I think you have just dealt with what I wanted to deal with. Was my initial question was not answered satisfactory, because it bowed towards the fact that the institutionalization of chaos, which National Treasury is getting into, and as a result, the outcome is not going to be different. It's going to be worse from what we see in the appeals from them in terms of certification of the extensions, this and that, in terms of their own operations. If indeed they do this consciously, they would have done it even better, without denying the fact that the accounting officers must be in the forefront to account for their own action. The fact is that now, as we speak, they're unable to, and further down, even Treasury attests to the difficulty of making them to account for or their ill-conceived decisions in as far as matters of procurement are concerned. That is the case in point. And nevertheless, they have issued the notice. And from us, I think, Chair, we really need to put up a sharp eye on those matters which we think are valid for the outlook of accountability and oversight. And Treasury would be responsible for whatever that goes all in as far as such matters are concerned. There will be no way to escape it, because they have opened the doors wide for such actions to negate the proper observation of legal parameters to hold procurement quite appropriately. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, that's fundamentally the point, Babsoni, because, I mean, if the acting CPO speaks about if things increase and so on, the KwaZulu-Natal scoper, for example, is dealing with an accumulation of 48 billion rands of irregular expenditure in that province, and they want, the departments have applied for condemnation, and you're dealing with about 13 billion rands. So, yeah, let's just get a response, a reaction from National Treasury on this.
Chair, the Honourable Chair, and Honourable Members, the concern of the committee, of the subcommittee, is noted. I think what had happened when Instruction Note 3, 16, 17 was put in place, the National Treasury's intent at that time was to make sure that there is a central point where balances and checks are done with regards to the deviations and modification. And at that time, it was important that National Treasury exercise a thorough analysis of what is happening. And I think that need still exists even now. But what had not been considered at the time was how crippling would that be, or what the impact would that be in the operational requirements of some of these opportunities, some of these organs of states where the operational challenges requires a decision as in pronto. However, what we have put in place now is to ensure that we exercise our oversight responsibility by making sure that reporting happens periodically and we interrogate. Our methodology for interrogating the reports that we receive will not be just incidental, based on the incident as it is reported. we would quite intensify our analysis based on historical information and based on what we perceive to happen moving forward. So the whole methodology with regards to analysis of the data will not be linear in nature with regards to what we are receiving. What we would not be able to justify immediately when we analyze the data would be the authenticity or the validity of whether that was a legitimate single source or that was a legitimate modification. But what we would be able to curb would be government irregular expenditure based on an incorrect decision moving forward. But I must indicate, Chair, at this present moment that the PFMA's intent was put in place to put a framework under which the accounting officers will operate. And the accounting officers must be made responsible and accountable for the decisions that are made correctly and incorrectly. And what we have been shying away from for years now is making sure that the accounting officers are held accountable by executive and by all the other law enforcement agencies in instances where incorrect decisions were taken or facetious decisions are also taken. National Treasury's responsibility also, which has not been seen to have been effective, was how do they exercise their oversight responsibility and reporting and analysis of the reports that we receive. Even if we were to stop or to withhold some of these account responsibilities from the accounting officers temporarily until they've put mechanisms in place, we will do that as National Treasury. But we gotta have to provide enough a compliance to PFMA fully with regards to making sure that the accounting officers take accountability and monitoring of these trends has to happen from National Treasury. And we have already started with regards to putting together the methodology we would use and finalize it and get it signed off by executive within National Treasury on how this monitoring would happen. But the reporting requirements have already been issued with an instruction note, and therefore we would analyze them as we receive them. I have indicated, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, that moving forward indicates that from a human resource perspective, the behavioral changes have not happened. Even when we have instituted investigations and put balances and checks in place, certainly National Treasury is obligated to review the decision that they have taken and make sure that a better corrective action is put in place, which will make sure that government works and it works in the manner that these oversight subcommittees require of National Treasury moving forward. That's what I can say on the matter at this moment, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. And the concern of the committee, of the subcommittee, would be related to the DG of the department, so that he is aware of such. Unfortunately, could not join us. He had bereavement in the last week, and therefore is still on leave. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's going to be favorable that we have this discussion further, because two things emerge from the response that you gave CPO. One is that obviously National Treasury has not been able to build up the capacity required to manage this server since this instruction note was issued in 2016. And the second point is that the point about accountability of accounting officers, which your DGs and your boards, hold office, that they must account, is well taken. But that comes at the tail end. It's post the fact. And what was in place was a system of check and balance, analysis and critique, and just a matter of due process to curb a situation where expansions and deviations are abused, exploited, or used willy-nilly. And as we've said, I think the phrase is commonplace now in this committee that expansions and deviations are not a norm but an exception. We've repeatedly said that. And now CPO is saying, well, let that happen and then hold them accountable. So, all right, no, it's fine. Colleagues, are there any further comments, questions in this regard? All right, going once, going twice, going thrice. All right. I think Acting CPO, I think do convey to, I think this is a discussion you need to have, the concerns of the Standing Committee on this matter. And that we will reflect on it and consult with the Standing Committee on Finance as well. And there may be a need to review this. We probably even need to Standing Committee on Appropriations as well and review this. I don't think that its application has been consistent with, prudent financial management in the current climate that we are in and the trends that have emerged. So we will probably come back to you on this. Not probably, we will come back to you on this so that we give a final position on it and allow members to look at it afresh, and our research team will interrogate it further, having heard the presentation that you have made this morning. And please do convey, finally, our condolences to the Director General on behalf of the committee to him and his family. So thank you very much, Acting CPO, to you and your team. We will meet next week with National Treasury. There's another meeting with yourselves. On that note, colleagues, let me say, tomorrow, Honorable Lees, we are meeting with the Auditor General to get a report on the Road Accident Fund and on SAA. So it's not the meeting on the disposal of the 51%, but it's an AG briefing in terms of how far things are or whether things have moved or not moved, so that we get the updated report on the status quo of the financials from an audit perspective of those institutions. The meeting with Public Enterprises and National Treasury and SAA on the disposal of the 51% is next week. And on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, we'll be dealing with the ESCOM report. So that is that. I'm sure that there's the draft program will be circulated to members. We are just awaiting the finalization of the schedule of the budget votes so that we do not duplicate, or rather, we should not schedule departments and or entities on days when they are doing budget votes. So as soon as that arrives, it's finalized, in large part, then we will be able to concretize on our programs. That's the difficulty of the second term, is that it comes with the budget votes. So that's that for tomorrow. So colleagues, if there's no other comments, the meeting is tomorrow, 9:30, and then the next meeting will be next week, same time. So without any further ado, in the absence of any other comments or questions by colleagues, the meeting stands adjourned. And thank you very much, colleagues. Have a good day further. The House will sit at 1400 hours today. Thank you very much, colleagues.
Thank you. Thank you,
Chair. Thank you, Chair.